You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
I'm Allison Footer, and this is MLB.com Extras NL West. I am here with my colleague, Ken Gernick, who covers the Dodgers for MLB.com. And Ken, as we have discussed all the way through the offseason, the Dodgers, there seems to be a lot of things that everyone thinks they need to do. And sometimes we forget that they did win 94 games last year. They were in the playoffs. They have pretty good pitching. But they haven't won the World Series, as you pointed out, since 1988, and that is something that is bothering a lot of people in the organization. So they do expect to be active, and of course they have the money to maybe be a little bit more active than some other teams. But what everyone, of course, has been talking about is the fact that they have too many outfielders. So somebody is probably going to be traded. I think they would prefer Ethier, but Kemp may be the guy that brings them the most. Where do you see that shaking out?
That seems to be pretty accurate from everything we can gather, although the Dodgers have been playing it pretty close to the vest. The rumors that are coming out, I don't believe, are coming out from the Dodgers. The only thing they really have said is they want to trade one of those outfielders, and they obviously have too many. So they'll do that, whether it's here or somewhere between now and spring training. As you said, Ethier probably would be the one that they would prefer to move. Kemp is clearly the one that would bring the most in return if they don't make Puig available, and there's no indication that they will. I personally feel it'd be a surprise if they trade Kemp, especially after already losing a right-handed bat in Hanley Ramirez. I think that'd be an awful big double hole to fill. So I think Kemp is out there in case they get bowled over, but it's more likely to be someone like Ethier or even Carl Crawford.
And it's just the money that they're all owed is obviously the big thing here. But I guess when it comes to Kemp, I mean, you just keep hearing his name, but they probably want his name to stay out there because they would kind of like to get bowled over. And it's not out of the question that they might, given the year that Kemp is coming off of and what his value is.
Well, when they're talking about moving an outfielder, it's because they have a surplus. Mm-hmm. So it's someone that they don't really feel is helping the team that much. But this is not a trade to help the team. It's a trade to help the number problem. So Kemp would be the one player who could return them enough that they would say that this is a trade that actually helps the roster. But it would have to help. And like I said, taking away that power bat, especially the way he bounced back in the second half of the year, I don't see how they can afford to lose that bat unless they really get something special in return.
I found it funny, like on its face, when you see that they traded for an outfielder in Chris Heisey, everyone stops and says, wait, what's going on? And of course, they have put together this front office that knows what it's doing. So when you really dissect it, though, it actually makes sense. So what was Farhan Zaidi's thinking through that whole thing to bring him in the organization?
Well, I think It's just maybe step two and before you make step one. You know, you're going to trade an outfielder. You want a bench player. The reason they're trading an outfielder is they have four guys who think they should be starting, and one of them can't. I think in Heisey they're looking at a guy who understands that it'll be a bench role, who's very good off the bench as a pinch hitter. He also has center field skills where the Dodgers, in spite of the fact that they have a lot of outfielders, they don't have a lot of center fielders. So I think he fits some specific needs for that roster, and just the fact that he's an outfielder is just one of those needs. And it will also provide them with the depth so that when they do move one of these top four outfielders, they will still have enough depth to have bench players.
Now, it comes to the Dodgers. Of course, they are a team that can be high bidders and be in the mix for all of these free agents that we're hearing out there. And there's a lot of names that everyone's waiting for John Lester to sign somewhere so that everybody else can start signing places. And the Dodgers are interested. So you gave them a pretty high odds of maybe signing him. Where do you see that?
Well, I don't know. And I don't think they want us to know. My guess is he'll probably go back to Boston. But because that isn't the number one priority for the Dodgers. However, in Stan Kasten and his history, he loves to go all in on pitching. So to that extent, it wouldn't surprise me if they come away with a rotation just loaded with starting pitching and try to go pitching and defense all the way. But that requires spending $150, $160 million on top of the fact that they already have about the most expensive rotation in baseball without him. So that really would be going all in.
Don Mattingly, I don't know that he gets enough credit. I heard a player when Manager of the Year awards were being given out, and somebody said that Mattingly should have been in the conversation for the way that he is able to handle a clubhouse that, you know, we hear things here and there, and we hear bits and pieces of what's going on inside those clubhouse walls. But Don Mattingly really might be a little underrated when it comes to how he is able to create a balance between managing on the field, which he gets criticized for as not the greatest tactician, but he gets really high marks for how he's able to just manage that whole, the personalities. Would you say that that's accurate?
You know, back-to-back division titles, not easy to do in any division. And he's done that. They win 94 games. And that clubhouse was a very, very interesting place to be. A lot of personalities, a lot of stars. He had the outfield problem from day one. Having to juggle that and keep the peace, it wasn't easy. You know, but they did a really good job, and you have to give him credit for that. You know, he may get knocks on his game management, but he won 94 of them. A lot of teams didn't do that. A lot of managers with big names and bigger salaries didn't win 94 games. So, yeah, I think you have to give him a lot of credit for that.
When you look at Yasiel Puig, I mean, we hear about him. I mean, you cover the team every day. You know him. I mean, it's just kind of, is it strange, like the kind of the – it's not really a perception. I mean, we hear some of the bizarre things that might go on a little bit, but do you see him kind of maturing as time goes on? I mean, he's still very young. And where do you see him kind of ending up as a major league player, being able to handle major league life?
Yeah, I don't know that I can answer that.
Yeah.
Has he matured? I don't know. There's a lot of signs that he hasn't, you know. But on the other hand, he has cut down on some of the mistakes he's made in the game. So I think he's learning the game. You know, learning how to be a big leaguer on and off the field, that takes a lot. And whether it's his background or just his personality, I think he's still got a long way to go. And I think the Dodgers would tell you that. But he's also kind of a freak when it comes to his ability. He can do things that nobody else can do. And he's compelling to watch. The fans love him. And even his teammates, you know, they shake their head. They can't believe, good and bad, the kinds of things he does. So he's a compelling player and kind of the face of that franchise, you know, outside of Clayton Kershaw.
Does he have – are there teammates that he has that are kind of mentors to him? Have they taken him under their wing, anybody specifically?
I don't know that he really seeks that. Maybe off the field. And a lot of the Latin players, you know, Juan Uribe has, in certain cases, Adrian Gonzalez. But he's kind of his own man, too. And he's sort of a man-child, you know. There are times when he looks like he's, you know, just got, you know, boundless energy and excitement and plays out of control like a little kid. And then there are times when he actually calms down. He loves visiting kids and helping kids. He's a very complicated, interesting individual to observe. And then during a game, he's hard to take your eyes off of.
Now, the Dodgers also have kind of an issue that a lot of teams have in deciding, like, when is the right time to bring up prospects and give them a real legitimate shot at an everyday starting job. They have a 20-year-old shortstop that might be able to handle the job in 2015. And then there are some other minor league prospects that might have gotten their feet wet a little bit that may be ready. Are there guys that are sort of untouchable, you know, players that they really want to hang on to that they wouldn't consider, you know, including in any trades that might be making an impact in 2015?
Well, the three players that they haven't wanted to trade are Jock Peterson, who went 30-30 at AAA, so you figure he's got to be in the big leagues this year. Corey Seager, who isn't ready. He's 20, but he's close. They think he'll be a shortstop, even though a lot of scouts think he'll be a third baseman. And because he's close, I don't think they want to go out and get a shortstop with any kind of multi-year commitment. And then the third best would be Julio Urias, 18-year-old left-handed pitcher, who at 18 isn't ready, although he's advanced beyond his years. Those would be the three that's so-called untouchables. And then it seems to drop off. They don't have the depth in the farm system that I think they feel they should. I think that's part of the reason why they've pretty much clean house in the front office and are starting all over, restructuring with new people in charge. They want to get back to the days when the Dodgers were able to draft, sign, and develop their own players, both from in the country and also scout internationally. And because they shut that down for a few years and it's cost them a lot in player development, they want to be able to develop their own players and not have to go out on the free agent market and trade every winter meetings to try and rebuild the team.
Thank you very much, Ken. And I am here with my colleague, Chris Haft, who covers the world champion Giants for our wonderful website. And Chris, we've discussed this over long periods of time, and if Sandoval leaves, who will replace him? And now Sandoval has left, so who's going to replace him? So now that we're at the winter meetings, where does all of this stand?
They've been linked to Chase Headley a lot, and a lot of speculation. It's more than just speculation, but I don't think they want to overpay for him. Of course, no team wants to do that, but the Giants are very sensitive to that. If that doesn't work out, they may take a look at a Jed Lowry type of guy, or Jed Lowry himself, or that sort of player. Maybe might have to be a player who switches from another position. Maybe to somebody who they can get for just 1 year, because next year's free agent class is projected to be much stronger than this year's. So they may be willing to just kind of go with a stopgap type of person for a season, and then proceed from there.
So we heard a lot when Sandoval was still, when the Giants were still in the mix for him, basically that they needed to go pretty hard after him because they didn't have much coming up through the system third base-wise. And like you said, just a little bit of a shortage of really good third basemen on the market. So, but you're saying that still continuing, like when you look at the organization, there's just not an abundance at third base.
Not an abundance. I personally think I'd like to see them give Adam Duvall or Chris Dominguez, their AAA guys, a shot. That's just my personal opinion. Look what happened with Joe Panik last year. I mean, I defer to the Giants' brain trust. Obviously, they've, with 3 World Series titles in 5 years, I think they know a lot more about baseball and talent evaluation than I do. That being said, I'd like to see one of those guys, get a chance. I mean, who knows what opportunity, from following the game for so long, opportunity sometimes is all the player needs to excel and or even just survive. And so, I'd like to see one of those two guys get a shot, but it doesn't look like it's going to happen that way.
And I think the Giants are probably, you say like Joe Panik, and he kind of came out of nowhere, and look how amazing he was. But even though the Giants, yes, they know what they're doing, that might have taken them off guard a little bit, though. I mean, even they had to be a little bit surprised that it worked out that well so quickly.
I don't think they thought he would excel that much that quickly. Mm-hmm. Being a first-round draft pick, sure. They right. expect him to make some impact at some point. But, I don't know if there's any substitute for baseball instinct, and he certainly showed a lot of that aside from the, statistical accomplishments and the instinct. I mean, we saw that in that game 7 with that stop he made up the middle. I mean, you just don't practice that stuff.
It was a game changer, a World Series changer,
yes.
Really. Okay, now I'm reading your coverage, and you say that you've talked to experts and scouts that say that the Giants have little to no chance to sign John Lester. Well, he's dissing the world champions. What, why do you feel that way? You gave him very low odds. They just don't seem to be in the mix for him.
Well, Allison, that was a few days ago. I think of
has it changed?
It seems like the landscape has changed a little bit. Other outlets have reported that part of their delegation to try to woo Lester included Buster Posey, who made a very strong pitch. And Buster's a smart guy. He can be a really eloquent guy. And I can imagine, he probably got John Lester fired up about joining the Giants. So I did write, since last week, that if the Giants are willing to go to 7 years, which, of course, is a huge risk. They did it with Barry Zito, though, so there's a precedent before the 2007 season. If they're willing to go to 7 years with Lester, maybe they could get him. And they just might be willing to do that.
it's funny because that just shows how quickly the news cycle is, that just sitting here and recording these over that period of time, things have obviously changed. Buster Posey, I mean, that's interesting that they're having somebody recruit. It's like a college recruiting trip.
Yeah, Buster would probably, I'll bet Buster got recruited heavily himself. So he knows what he's doing. And I guess Bruce Bochy was part of that contingent also. And, you know, Bruce is an impressive guy. Maybe he doesn't knock you off your feet, but just with his stature, what he's accomplished in the game, and his no-nonsense, respectful yet no-nonsense way in which he addresses people, I think that must have had, I would hope that had some effect with John Lester.
It's funny because we talk about the team winning the World Series, having won three in the last 5 years, but just coming off of a championship, yet we sit and say they really need help with their starting rotation. But as you pointed out, Lincecum, you don't know what you're going to get from him, and Tim Hudson is going to turn 40 next year, and Matt Cain is coming off of a pretty severe elbow injury. So they really can't sit back and just sort of hope that the chips fall in their favor. They really do have to be aggressive, maybe a little bit more aggressive than a World Series team might have to be that first offseason.
They do have to be proactive, and even Madison Bumgarner, who you would think is the one sure thing, he threw 270 innings this year, including the postseason. Yes, he's big and strong, and no, I don't think he's going to take a big dive statistically next year, performance-wise, but they're going to have to watch, they're going to monitor him carefully and make sure he doesn't wear out too early.
I was looking at his, I think I was during the World Series, I was just kind of, I Googled him just to look at his age, the amount of innings that he had on his arm. That is a concern. I mean, I think that it's maybe not as dramatic as people thought it would be, like, oh, if you have this amount of innings by this age, then there's going to be a significant drop off. But like you said, I mean, the amount of innings, studies have shown that the following season can be a little bit difficult.
He could be an, as they say, outlier, because he's so big and strong. He's country strong, as people have noticed. As somebody else pointed out to me, though, so is Justin Verlander. So we'll have
point.
To we'll just have to see what happens.
We've not really looked at. There's like a kind of a second tier of third basemen that they might be able to look at. You listed a few of those, so that's certainly something that we haven't really talked a lot about. We haven't really read a lot about, but that they could sort of dip into David Fries,
yeah.
And of that ilk.
I think a David Fries would fit in real well. There's a guy who, I mean, the expectations wouldn't be real high. I think they've diminished for him in the last few years, but that's not necessarily a negative. The now departed third base coach Tim Flannery sang in one of his songs, it's never too late to be the person you're supposed to be, and it's never too late to be the player you can be, until they take the uniform away from you. So a guy like a David Fries probably would help them quite significantly.
And it's funny you bring him up, because I wanted to end this with Tim Flannery. I always said the third base coach is one of the toughest jobs, because they don't notice all the good things that you do when you send them home and they're safe, and then they get a really hard time when you send them home and they're out. You always say that, the fan bases of every team, they don't like their third base coach. They think their general manager needs to be fired. They think that they're the worst team at scoring from third with less than two outs. It's like that kind of standard thing. Tim Flannery was an extremely, not only popular with the team, but popular in the city. And that's a big loss. I mean, he just kind of out of the blue, he retired, I guess, from baseball.
Yeah.
And so what kind of impact would that have on the team?
I think the team will survive, but yeah, they're going to miss him. There's no doubt about that. He was just, he was a spiritual guy, not in the maybe in the literal sense, but people could relate to him. One of the most poignant things I heard him say was back in 2010, when the Giants were going for their first of these three World Series titles. They're playing a September series in Chicago. I'll try to make this quick. And I was talking to Buster Posey, who was then a rookie, and he was saying, "Yeah, I wish we could fast forward to the end to see how this turns out," because they were battling the Padres neck and neck for the division title. And Tim overheard us, and he said, "But then you wouldn't get to feel the pain." So it was the whole experience of baseball that that excited Tim about the game. You know, not just the good, but the bad. But you can't really appreciate the good without the bad. And that's why I think, that's partly what Tim meant. And, whoever they get, I'm sure he'll be a good man. But I don't know if he'll be as, as poetic and as, sensitive as Tim Flannery is.
And he and Bruce Bochy have a long history together. I'm sure it was pretty tough on him, on Bochy, to lose him.
I have not spoken to Bruce yet, but I'm sure it was. And, again, the players, really related to Tim, and even we writers did. I think the way I spoke of him, it makes, you can tell, there are things about him I'll always carry with me. So, but hopefully we'll cross paths again in the future.
I'm sure you will. Well, thank you very much, Chris. I am here with my colleague and good friend, Corey Brock, who covers the Padres for MLB.com. So, Corey, let's talk about, we are here at the winter meetings, and everybody is sort of talking about what may happen. And as we have been discussing for most of the offseason, really dating back to the 2014 season, is that the Padres need to upgrade their offense. So what do you think will happen this week and even beyond as far as the wheeling and dealing that might go on?
Yeah, it's funny, Allison. A lot of these teams come to the winter meetings or at least enter the off season with this maybe kind of diverse shopping list of things they want to address. Catching needs, starting pitching, corner infield. For the Padres, it's items A, B, C, and D, offense. And a lot of discussions either in terms of free agency, trades, looking for upgrades across the board, really. They could stand to use some help, first base, third base, the outfield. I think they're kicking the tires on a lot of different things at this point. First-year general manager A.J. Preller doing a lot of due diligence here. This is his first rodeo in terms of, trying to head up a department. Has his group in place, has had an awful lot of discussions with agents and with teams. I think the Padres are going to be active this week and moving forward. A lot of seeds have sort of been planted, and I would expect them to make something happen. They have to make something happen. This was the worst offense in baseball in 2014, and in the month of June, this was historically the worst month of baseball in the modern era. So they have to make some changes. The pitching was very good. Starting pitching, relief pitching, no problems there, but they have to find some upgrades. And, they may have to part with an asset or two to do that, which isn't ideal, but I think they're going to get something done here in the next few days.
And it's funny because we talk about the Padres being a team that really needs to focus more on making a deal, a trade, more than really the free agent market. But they were actually pretty active when it came to maybe, bidding on some free agents of Pablo Sandoval. They were in that. Yosmani Tomas, they made a bid for that. So it's not just the trades. They are really, they do have a little bit of money to spend.
Yeah, this is kind of a new era for the Padres, something we haven't necessarily seen before. But, Executive Chairman Ron Fowler has given A.J. Preller some financial flexibility to go out and make a deal, make a free agent deal. And, our understanding is they went 6 years and in excess of $100 million on Pablo Sandoval, who ultimately signed a five-year, $95 million deal with the Red Sox. But, whatever the saying is about coming close and horseshoes and whatever. But, they also chased Yasmani Tomas and to a certain extent. But we're certainly all in on Sandoval, and I think they would have been very happy to have landed him. So, I think they're willing to take on some salary if they needed to in a trade. There's still some free agent options out there. So, I think if I'm a Padre fan, you're looking at a franchise that has not made the postseason since 2006. You have not only seen the Giants win three World Series here now in the last decade or so here, but the Dodgers won 94 games this past year. But this is a division where it's been volatile in the past, and there is some room for some upward mobility, but you have to be able to score a few runs to do so. They have the pitching in place to make some moves, but you have to be able to score some runs.
And really the general philosophies in baseball, it's not a hard and fast rule, but it's hard to trade away pitching to get hitting. It's generally the other way where you don't want to give up pitching. It's at such a premium to get a hitter, but they may end up doing that. So if they were to make a deal for a hitter, what players would be more expendable or tradable?
Well, I think that's why making your mark in free agency, if you can, is always a better way to go, because trading asset for asset, no matter how talent-rich your system is, and they don't have a whole lot of upper-level minor league prospects to move in a deal. So you're looking at the potential of maybe moving someone off the major league roster to get some interesting pieces in return. Yasmani Grandal, the catcher, who had major knee surgery in August of 2013. His knee is fully healed. I would suspect that, I know they're getting an awful lot of hits on him from other teams. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's a cornerstone of a deal they make. He alone is not going to bring you what you need. There may be a series of moves. There might be a package. Ian Kennedy could be a pitcher that they move. It'd be easier to cover for his loss with some other arms in the system. They really don't want to break up Andrew Cashner and Tyson Ross at the top of that rotation. Those guys would certainly get you what you need in terms of getting a big bat, which is kind of a running joke here in San Diego. People are always waiting on that big bat to arrive. but you would certainly be weakening yourself in terms of the starting rotation. So that's kind of a delicate balance. And if you're A.J. Preller doing this for the first time, these are some of the heavy factors that you have to weigh moving forward.
And you keep hearing Matt Kemp's name coming up as something that could really happen, which sounds it just sounds like, why would it happen in interdivision? But that you keep hearing the Padres' name come up when discussing, Matt Kemp.
Yeah, and I think there's some legitimate reasons for it. I had the same reaction you did, Allison. I'm still trying to figure out why the Dodgers would want to trade him, especially now that Hanley Ramirez and his bat have moved on. I'm not sure where they're going to find the power that they need. He's owed $107 million over the next 5 years, which may seem steep. If the Padres were willing to take on $100 million-plus for Pablo Sandoval, maybe that's a little easier to digest. Maybe the Dodgers kick in some money there. Then you get into some defensive issues and you try and figure out where you're going to play him. Defensive metrics haven't necessarily been kind to him in recent years, but there's no disputing the bat, especially the way it played in the second half. And, he would immediately become your best hitter in the lineup. They've been linked to Jay Bruce, Cespedes, Justin Upton, who is only under control for one more year. So there's pluses and minuses to a lot of these guys. And if you're the Padres, you may only have one chance to make a big deal here, just because you don't have a whole lot of assets and you got to be careful to hang on to a lot of these guys. So I think this is why A.J. Preller, this is why a deal hasn't been made yet. I think they're really carefully weighing their options. They want to get this right.
And a couple of less notable but still significant things. Clint Barmas, signing him, so he'll be sort of a backup infielder. He's a veteran guy. I had some experience covering him in Houston. He's a great guy. He's a real good clubhouse guy and a good mentor for young players. And so that's kind of what they were going for with that.
Yeah, exactly. They non-tendered shortstop Everett Cabrera a week or so ago. And A.J. Preller mentioned, they're going to look for some middle infield depth. Just because you don't want to be left naked in the middle of the field there. You need someone that can play some shortstop. And lo and behold, the next day they signed Clint Barmas. So A.J. moved awfully quick on that. But good clubhouse guy, a guy that can move around. excuse me. A guy that can move around the infield a little bit. Defense has kind of always been his forte. And, and I talked to him on the phone a little bit. And you mentioned the clubhouse presence. And I think that's a real thing, and I think fans kind of poke fun on it on Twitter and such. But it's a real thing that we don't necessarily see behind closed doors, but especially for a young team. And this is a guy that had some really good mentors when he was a young player in Colorado, Todd Helton, Desi Relaford, a whole bunch of guys there. And he's kind of passed that along the last couple years in Pittsburgh. And I think that's an important aspect. At the end of the day, yes, you need to be able to play. You have to contribute. The team didn't hire you to be a mentor, but he'll serve a valuable role on this team, being able to bounce around a little bit. And it's a one-year deal with a club option, so it's not they didn't sink a whole lot of money or resources into this, but a smaller move, and especially for an NL team where the bench plays a lot more important than the American League, I think it was a smart move.
And they hired a new hitting coach, which created a little bit of a buzz. I mean, I guess they've had a few over the years, but yeah. Mark Kotze certainly is a name and somebody that I guess Buddy Black said, you know, we really have to take a look at him and really give him some consideration. He ended up getting the job.
Yeah, it's been a kind of a interesting position for the Padres in recent years. I was thinking about it today, Allison. The hotel here has one of those spinning doors when you come in, you know, where, you know, you step in, you got to time it perfectly, otherwise you'll get hung up there. But, you know, the Padres have had 7 hitting coaches since Petco Park opened in 2004. And
wow.
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly the ballpark when it opened. Now, there have been some revisions since in terms of fence modifications and such, and it doesn't play nearly as big as it did before, and it's not all the ballpark's fault. So Mark Kotze is going to be the hitting coach. This is a guy that's only, you know, a year or so removed from his playing days, and I think that was an important component to this, a guy in terms of being able to relate to players and their struggles and kind of understanding what they've gone through and being a little bit more current. And it was kind of an interesting process with him in terms of he wasn't necessarily a candidate initially. He wasn't even on their initial list, but he was sitting in on interviews with other candidates, with A.J. Preller and Bud Black, and asking questions. And it kind of, you know, one of those like cartoon light bulb moments above the head there where Buddy Black and A.J. Preller are like, you know, probably listening to these questions that Kotze is asking. And like, well, hey, maybe we should talk to him about this. So Mark Kotze went from actually asking questions of potential hitting coaches to being a candidate himself to getting the job. So I guess he had some keen insight to what they were looking for, but he's excited for the challenge. This is certainly not something that he has to do, but, you know, he spent a year away from the game. He was worked in the front office as a special assistant to the general manager, Josh Burns, and then Preller, of course, when he was hired in August, and got to see the other side of things. The Padres have done that with some guys who have recently retired from the game. Good friend Brad Ausmus, Mark Loretta, they've done that as well. And get a sample of what life's like after playing and if you want to remain connected to the game. And I think Mark Kotze kind of understood that his calling wasn't the front office, it was being in uniform.
Very interesting. Well, thank you, Corey, very much. And I'm joined by my colleague and one of my favorite people, really on earth, Thomas Harding, who covers the Rockies for MLB.com.
I don't know if I can live up to that.
How are you, Thomas?
I feel good. I feel clean.
I knew you were going to say that. No doubt. So let's talk about the Rockies. Here we are at the winter meetings, and we have discussed at length things that they may do, could do, want to do. But let's talk about it in, you know, somewhat realistic terms. Is there a deal to be made? They want to improve their pitching, obviously. So where do you think that they stand with that?
Well, I think that's the key, is that they want to leave here having improved their pitching. Usually the trade is probably the best thing for them because they don't sign big on the free agent market, and a lot of free agents don't necessarily want to come to Denver, although I'm not sure that's as true as people say it is. But the best way to do it is through a trade. Do they go really big with the trade, trading a Troy Tulowitzki or Carlos Gonzalez? Those deals may be out there. Or do they go just a little bit smaller? Maybe it's a Justin Morneau who's coming off of a batting title, or something a little bit lower on the scale of pay on that roster. One way or the other, they're going to have to find a way to get pitching. And if they don't do it, then they're going to have to look at the free agent market.
So what's the catching situation? You kind of hear that they may want to, like, tool around a little bit with that.
Yes, they do have 2 catchers who are under contract and arbitration eligible, Willie Rosario and also Michael McHenry. Rosario has struggled defensively, but he's a very good power hitter offensively. So you look at those skills and you say, hey, why not look at an American League team, and maybe they want to make a deal, and then the Rockies go back on the free agent market for a veteran defensive type catcher.
Now you see the Rockies' name come up a little bit. I mean, they're a little bit quieter than some of the other teams in their division as far as just hearing the rumors. And of course, 99% of the rumors that we hear do not happen. It might even be like 99.5% of the rumors. But you do hear that there might be like a match with the Mets and the Rockies, perhaps. I mean, they do have like a surplus in pitching. Do you think that a deal could possibly happen there?
I think it's possible with the New York Mets because of that fact. The fact they've got guys like Dylan Gee and John Neese and also Noah Syndergaard. Guys like that. Pitching depth, which you look at it, the Mets need a shortstop. The Rockies need pitching quality and depth. That just looks like a match so much to me. But whether that can be worked out, I'm not sure. I mean, what do the Mets want to give up considering some of the injuries that Tulowitzki has had in the past? Do the Rockies really want to give up that piece of their lineup? Or maybe can they get the pitching through some other deal and have Troy Tulowitzki hitting like an MVP, which is what he did for three quarters of the season before he was hurt?
Yeah, I find it. I mean, we've discussed this at length, and we've been doing these podcasts for several months now, and I am very, I kind of scoff at the amount of conversation that we have heard about possible deals for Tulowitzki and Gonzalez, as you know, because mainly because there are injury issues, there's health issues, and these gigantic contracts, so it's so complicated for something to actually come to fruition, yet Troy Tulowitzki's name continues to come up in rumors, really all around. So what's your gut at this point? I mean, we talked about this in August. We talked about it in September. I don't think we talked in October, but we picked it back up in November. So where do you see that now?
I still think it's possible this week. And if it doesn't happen soon, then this will come up again at the deadline if the Rockies fall out of contention. Now, if everybody stays healthy and they've got a chance, they're going to be adding to that team. They wouldn't be subtracting Tulowitzki or Gonzalez, who may be a little bit easier to trade for. But I think right now when you're looking at a team that's trying to figure out how to get pitching, the realization sets in, you have to give up something to get something. Is Troy Tulowitzki what you have to give up, or can you do it in another way?
So basically what we're looking at is if Tulowitzki and Gonzalez are healthy, then the Rockies probably be somewhere hanging around contention.
Correct. And this wouldn't be
And they
be
wouldn't
as big
want to trade him.
Exactly.
And
then unless the – now, I will say, though, that there have been years where they've had healthy guys and they've hit and they've led the league in hitting. If the pitching is that bad where it drags it down, then that's when you have a big question to ask yourself. Can you really afford to keep these guys when you can't pitch?
Right. And what would the answer to that be? No. Yes. So as far as, like, the payroll goes, are they kind of – where do you see that ending up?
I see it going up some. It was a little over $93 million last season, and I've talked to the new general manager, Jeff Breidich, and he has said that he is under no orders to move payroll. That's another part of this whole Tulowitzki-Gonzalez picture. If they were saying we have to reduce the payroll, then that would almost put them in a kind of a desperate situation where maybe they trade these guys, even get less in return, and then hope to spend some free agent savings. But they don't have to cut the payroll. And if they don't make a big trade here at the winter meetings and they still need pitching, they're going to have to get on the free agent market and get it. And maybe that would drive the payroll up over $100 million for the first time in team history.
Now there's a feeling like in the industry that you have to keep emotions and sentimentality out of any kind of actual, you know, dealings that you're making and when you look at the team. But there seems to be a very close relationship between Tulowitzki and the owner of the Rockies. So, I mean, that seems to be a factor also. And Tulowitzki is like, you know, like Denver's guy. Do you think that would factor in at all?
I think it could factor in some, but I think ultimately it has to be a baseball decision. And I believe they're prepared to make a baseball decision, whether it's keep him, whether it's trade him. I think with the fan base there, they like him. They certainly like what he does, but they do get frustrated when he's injured. And let's face it, the team hasn't won. And when you look at a guy like Tulowitzki, he wants to win. The Rockies want to win. Their fans want to win. It would be nice if they all won together, but would winning be possible if they separated? That's a tough question for any team to ask about a star player.
How does their farm system look to you? Where is it? Is it a good place? Are they? I don't know where they're ranked in the Baseball America recent rankings.
When I look at their farm system, a lot of the real quality is kind of coming out of the Class A level, really. They do have some pitching a little bit above that. Eddie Butler appeared for the Rockies last year. There was a lot of hype about him, but in his first major league start, he suffered shoulder problems. He's rehabbing that, hoping that's okay. John Gray, the number one draft pick of a couple of years ago, he had a very good year in AA, but at the end, they shut him down in the AA playoffs just to protect his shoulder. And I'm not sure exactly where that stands. Hopefully that just a winner of rehab, that's fine. Another recent number one draft pick, Tyler Anderson, a left-hander, he got shut down at the end of the AA season because of elbow issues, and they really believe that he could rehab that and be ready. We'll see what happens in spring training. So There is young pitching at the Double A level. Behind that, there are a whole lot of hitters that this team has at the Class A level, and that's where the strength of the organization is. When I talk to scouts for other organizations, they say, wow, look at that, the Low A Asheville team, which won its championship. There are hitters there. There were hitters at Modesto. So there is hitting on the way. It's just a little bit away.
And let's talk. We talk about, you know, wheeling and dealing and guys that could come and guys that could go. But you have the Rockies have a third baseman, Nolan Arenado, who is a two-time Gold Glove winner. He's really coming up and is kind of a guy that might solidify this roster for a while.
Yes, he looks like the new Tulowitzki, kind of the guy that you build a team around. He was drafted in the second round several years ago for his bat, and nobody was sure that he would be the great fielder that he is. Well, he's come up and won two Gold Gloves in his first two seasons in the major leagues. That's a rare feat in baseball at any position, and definitely at third base also. Offensively, I saw some improvement last season. He's a guy that he looks like he has doubles power. He looks like he can hit for high average. The first year, there were times that he struggled, got into some bad habits. You saw a little bit of that early last year, but then he pulled things together. If he's hitting the ball hard and not striking out, which both of which he's capable of, he could become a true superstar, an all-star type player.
Walt Weiss, the manager, let's end talking about him a little bit. He's in this new wave of, you know, hiring managers with no past experience in coaching or managing. They kind of plucked him out. He seems to be somebody who has really taken to this and is enjoying the role that he has, would you say?
Yes, I think when he took it, he really wanted to do it, but he also wanted to kind of test and see, do I really want to do this? And I think the Rockies were like, do we really have the right guy? I thought last year he put his stamp on the team a little bit more. That team plays hard. They do listen to him. I think he's able to teach guys how to be professional. I know he badly wants to win, and that may be driving some of what's going on here, where if a team has had some of the records that the Rockies have had, they go ahead and they trade their guys because they're saying, hey, this isn't working. Let's start all over and wait 2 or 3 years. Well, offensively, Weiss felt all year this year and really the previous year that the team was capable of contending. So he wants to test and see if we hold on to these guys, can we contend if we get enough pitching?
Well, we'll wait and see what happens. It's very interesting. Thank you very much, Thomas. I am here with my colleague, Steve Gilbert, who has, since the beginning of MLB.com, covered the Arizona Diamondbacks for our website. So we have the expert on board here. And Steve, thank you very much for joining us. And let's start in on the Diamondbacks. We're active, signing Cuban slugger Yasmani Tomas, so a very lucrative contract. Very interesting, though, because now we're sort of hearing a few things about where he may play, and he might be tried out at third base. And it seems like he might not really be on board with that yet, but the organization certainly seems to think that that's where they'll look at him most at spring training.
Yeah, you know, it was a little bit of a surprise, but we thought that they saw him as an outfielder. At least that's what some of the reports that we had gotten were. But then Chappelle told us just last week that they're going to give him a shot at third base at first, and I think he's similar in weight to Pablo Sandoval, at least what he's listed as. So, you know, Pablo's had some success over there at third base. So if it does, then it gives him some options in the outfield. If not, they could probably play him out in left field and still be okay.
Does he have, I mean, when he's being compared to Pablo in size, girth, I mean, I'm not so sure that's like this wonderful thing. Like, oh, he could totally play third base because he's built like Pablo Sandoval. I mean, what do you know about Tomas? Is he a real fit guy? Does he keep himself in good shape?
You know, Dave Stewart has talked about the fact that he's redistributed some weight that he's had recently, and so he's getting in even better shape. He's got a lot of power, maybe a little more power than Pablo, and that's something that they really wanted in their lineup, that they really wanted to add to their lineup. And so it was a little bit of a surprise actually when the Diamondbacks came out on top in the bidding for him. I don't think a lot of people had him pegged going to Arizona at first, but they signed him to the largest contract in franchise history, $68.5 million, eclipsing Randy Johnson's deal from back in the day. So they believe that he can add a lot of power to that lineup, whether he plays a third or out in the outfield.
And it's funny because leading up to the winter meetings, it's all about like, okay, what does the team need to do? And they have to make some kind of splash during the winter meetings. And sometimes it's just the groundwork is being laid. But actually, when it comes to the Diamondbacks, they've been very active already. I mean, it wouldn't be shocking if they left San Diego and hadn't really done anything here. But they have upgraded their pitching. So obviously they need to probably do a little bit more in their starting rotation. But where do you see that all shaking out right now?
You know, Dave Stewart, I tell you, he's been a man of action since taking over. I mean, like you mentioned, I mean, he didn't wait for the winter meetings. He didn't even wait for the right after the GM meetings. He got Jeremy Hellickson. Before the winter meetings, they signed Tomas. Before the winter meetings, they made a deal to trade Didi Gregorius in a three-team deal that got them Robbie Ray and an infielder that they like. So he's been aggressive. And a matter of fact, when we asked him about some of the rumors that were out there about Miguel Montero last week, he said, well, you guys know how I operate. If I was inclined to move him, he'd probably be moved by now. So, I mean, he's this is his first taste of being a GM, and so far he's been very decisive in his moves. It sounds like if there's a move that he feels makes sense, they're going to do it, or at least their end, they're prepared to do it. It's a matter of waiting on other teams.
Those three-team trades are often very, well, they're not often very complicated. They're always very complicated, and it sort of just comes out of the blue. Just from the Diamondbacks' perspective, I mean, how difficult was it for them to sort of get all the pieces in place? And when you involve two other teams, like, kind of what's the anatomy of that whole situation?
Well, I think the Yankees were interested in Didi Gregorius, obviously, as a shortstop. And they engaged the Diamondbacks in some one-on-one talks, and they really couldn't find a match. The Diamondbacks didn't like didn't prefer some of the pitchers that the Yankees were offering. But now the Tigers did like one of the Yankee pitchers, and so Brian Cashman got Dave Dombrowski involved and said, hey, if you can get Didi Gregorius from the Diamondbacks, then we can give you this pitcher that you like. And so that's kind of how that transpired. And Tony La Russa, when he was studying kind of like how to get into the front office last year, spent a lot of time in Detroit with Dave Dombrowski because they go way back to Chicago in the early 80s. So he and Dave had a very good relationship. So it was kind of a natural there for them to be able to talk. And they liked, they liked Robbie Ray, a left-hander that they got, and they liked the infield prospect that they got. So it kind of went from there.
What was your reaction? I mean, you know Gregorius, so I know this is more like on the Yankees side. But, I mean, just what was your reaction to that? Okay, so now he's going to play for the Yankees. It's going to take Derek Jeter's place, no big deal. What kind of guy is he? And did you have a reaction like, oh, well, this is fine, this is something he can handle, or, you know, this might be a little bit difficult?
Well, you know, what was interesting about that whole thing is when the Diamondbacks acquired him, Kevin Towers, in a conference call with reporters, said that when he first saw Didi Gregorius, it reminded him of a young Derek Jeter. Now, he was referring to him as in terms of his athleticism, and when he saw him, you know, Derek
Jeter
in high
school.
Why do
people do that?
And he meant it as not like he's going to be the next Derek Jeter, but it's just so ironic that now he is going to be the guy that replaces Derek Jeter, apparently, for the Yankees. But Didi's kind of a quiet guy. It'll be interesting to see how he handles the spotlight in New York. I don't know how anybody handles a spotlight in New York very well. I mean, there's so much media attention. It's hard to know until they actually do it. But it'll be interesting to see how he handles it.
Now, Robbie Ray, let's talk about him a little bit, a power left-handed pitcher. So, I mean, I saw one comment like, well, we're not really sure where he fits in, whether it'll be like in the rotation or reliever. But then somebody else said he's definitely like a top to middle of the order or middle of the rotation guy. So what is he?
Well, I can tell you what Dave Stewart said. He sees him as a middle to upper rotation starter. Whether he's ready at the start of this year, I don't know. They're going to let him battle it out during spring training. But he was really the key to the deal for them. Again, trying to build depth in that rotation so that they can have some competition. They've had a couple of really bad injuries with Patrick Corbin and Bronson Arroyo, both needing Tommy John surgery. So they're trying to create some depth in that rotation. And so they see him as being a guy that, if he's on, can be mid to upper part of the rotation. And they liked what they saw of him. They got to see him in Arizona Fall League, kind of a home field advantage for the Diamondbacks because they get to see a lot of those guys down there.
That's
true. They see a lot of games. So they got some real good looks at him, they felt like, during the Fall League, and they feel like they got themselves a quality pitcher, and we'll see.
I saw that the Diamondbacks, their payroll is around $100 million, which surprised me a little bit because I sort of see them as a team that's trying to keep the cost down and still working towards something and hasn't quite gotten there. But do you see that the payroll kind of being around the $100 million mark?
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting thing how they juggle all this, because it was 110 at opening day last year, which was a franchise record. It was even bigger than it was in 01 and 02 when they were, you know, winning a World Series and winning division titles. So when we talked to Derek Hall about it last week, he said, yeah, we're probably right around $100 million right now. Probably would prefer to be around 90, 95. And they still have things on their wish list, the left-handed bat in the lineup, adding more depth to the pitching staff. So it's kind of be interesting to see how they finesse all that. Maybe it means trading a contract like Miguel Montero's to kind of make room in the payroll, because he's owed $40 million over the next 3 years. So, but right now their payroll is right around $100 million. And I think they probably lost some money last year given the way the team played and the attendance was down. So it's going to be it's interesting to see how they manage to get down to that 90-95 figure.
There's been a lot of changes throughout baseball in front offices and in the manager's office. And so Chip Hale, tell us a little bit about him. I mean, this was lauded throughout the industry when he was hired. I mean, he seems to be a very respected person. So what are your impressions of him, and how do you see him sort of fitting into this whole thing?
Chip's a competitor, and he's a guy that's paid his dues. He was a minor league manager after his major league playing career, and then he was a coach for a number of years. I can tell you how intense he is. I participate in that Diamondbacks fantasy camp every year to do stories for MLB.com, and he's a guy that takes that very seriously when he managed the team in the fantasy camp. He's a guy that his teams won it every year. They won the championship that he was there because he wanted every one of his guys to get – these are doctors and lawyers and not athletes, but he wanted every one of his guys to get better during the week, and that's the way he approaches everything. If they're keeping score, he wants to win. So – he's definitely a fiery guy, a competitive guy, and a guy that's paid his dues to get this opportunity.
That's one thing about baseball people, that it doesn't matter what they're doing. If it's just flipping a coin in the air just to pass 5 minutes, they want to win that. I mean, they are the most competitive people.
Well, I'll tell you, his team lost a morning game, and he told them all that he wanted them to spend the lunch hour. Now, keep in mind, these are people that paid a lot of money to be there. He wanted them to spend the lunch hour thinking about how they could be better for the afternoon game. So that'll tell you how competitive he is.
How did that go over well with the participants?
You know what? He had to have been
half joking.
What's that? I'm sure he was partially joking, but he was pretty intense. But they all kind of bought into it. He was able to get them to buy into, hey, if we're playing, we're going to win. It's more fun to win. So and he pushed everybody to get better and work on their skills and stuff. So it was whereas some of the managers were just more concerned with, you know, let's take it easy out there. Nobody get hurt, and let's all go out and have fun tonight. You know, so.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of strained hamstrings that can happen to these guys that pay thousands of dollars to participate in these things.
And I can personally vouch for that. And they get more strained as you get older and older, for sure.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras NL West.